Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is George Pelicanos, whose latest novel is The Way Home. Earlier novels include The Turnaround, Soul Circus, Hard Revolution. There are 16 novels in all. George Pelicanos was a writer and producer of the HBO series The Wire. He's an essayist. The latest novel, The Way Home, as with the other novels, is set in and around Washington, D.C. These are, I guess, noir or crime novels. There were series novels, but now it seems like you're doing standalone work.
Yeah, I don't really have a plan, but the last three books have been standalones, and I don't even know where I'm going next.
What are the origins of a particular book? Like, for instance, The Way Home. Did you have any idea while you were still, say, working on The Turnaround, what your next book would be? Anything?
No, and I never do. And oftentimes it just comes out of things I'm doing in my life. In this case, I had been working in prisons, both adult prisons and juvenile prisons for a while, teaching reading and literacy and that sort of thing, and just speaking to people and trying to tell them that their life is not over. You know, it's a bump in the road. I was in this juvenile prison called Oak Hill, which is D.C.'s prison for juveniles. And the boys were in class, and I was just kind of walking around. I had full access, and I went into this kid's cell. And nobody was there. And it was just a 6x9 room, a cot, an open commode sitting there in the middle of the floor, and a piece of plexiglass for a window that was so dirty you couldn't see out of it and no light was coming in. That right there was the premise for the book. What's it like for a kid to be in prison? What's it like for his parents? And how do they put it back together, put their lives back together and also their relationships back together when the kid comes out? That was just me walking into a cell and deciding that there's a book here.
The cell and the juvenile prison, is that the same one in the book?
Yes.
Pretty much? Yeah.
I call it Pine Ridge, but it's Oak Hill.
And it takes place several years prior to the ending of the book, around 2000, 2001, and there are changes. Did you seek historical accuracy at that point?
Well, the reason I did that is as follows. The first part of the book is set in 1999 when Oak Hill was notorious for being a very grim place. Kids were getting beat up, not just fighting between each other, but from the guards. You know, guards were bringing in marijuana and selling it to the boys. The school was a mess. The teachers there were the teachers who couldn't get hired in D.C. They sent them out there. The classes were huge because there was a lot of kids that didn't need to be locked up. Jail was overcrowded and so on. We got this guy, Vinny Schiraldi, who was out of San Francisco, worked in juvenile justice in San Francisco. He was hired by the mayor. He's been there since 2004, and there have been tremendous changes. He brought the Missouri model to D.C. Vinny has locked up less kids. You know, you don't want to put kids who are, for example, up on marijuana charges in with kids who have done manslaughters because the prison experience taints everybody. He's put a new school in there under the Maya Angelou charter, new teachers. Classrooms are small. Kids are getting degrees. They're out there working. They send some of these boys down to New Orleans after Katrina. They built a new prison, and these boys apprenticed as carpenters. Everything's going great, or it's getting a lot better. I did have an agenda because he's been under fire from my hometown newspaper, the Washington Post, who say that he's too soft on kids who are criminals. I wanted to show that this has been a very positive thing and that when people start talking about locking up kids, they need to think really hard about what they're doing.
Your work on The Wire, how does that influence you in terms of writing about kids in those chapters and in terms of your research? And also, do you think The Wire itself had an effect on how people looked at kids and what they were doing?
I hope it did. I think season four, which we were at our best, was the most affecting season because we showed what happens to kids in the city and how they're often powerless because of the forces of politics and the police and the schools. It was very emotionally affecting. I did get influenced by my work on the show simply because I was around a lot of good writers. I never went to writing school, so that was, in a way, my late-blooming writer school experience. And one of the reasons I didn't go is because I didn't think I'd be able to handle sitting around in a room with strangers telling me that, you know, what I was doing wrong. But to sit in a room with Richard Price, Dennis Lehane, David Simon, Ed Burns, then you're going to listen. And we all were tough on each other because we were trying to elevate the content of the show, and I think it showed in what we produce.
The thrust of the season, was that still David Simon?
Season four?
Yeah.
That season actually was, I would have to say, it was more Ed Burns, because Ed had worked not only as a police officer, but he had worked as a public school teacher in Baltimore for many years. He knew that world, and Ed had some very strong opinions about what needed to be done to make things better, and it's reflected in the plot mechanisms of that particular season.
There's a shout-out in The Way Home to Colvin.
Yeah, Warden Colvin.
Before we move back to this, the entire idea of New Hamsterdam, where did that come from?
People have been talking for years, what would happen if you legalized drugs? Would that solve the problems? I happen to believe, and I still believe, that marijuana should be legalized, or at the very least, severely decriminalized. But we wanted to take a broader look at it and say, what if we legalized all drugs? And in a small pocket of Baltimore, what would happen? And you'd think that we were pushing some kind of agenda and that we'd show that that's the answer and everything would be rosy. But as we wrote it and sat in these rooms for hours on end and discussed it, we also saw the potential pitfalls of that, and it's up on screen. The fact is that, take marijuana legalization. We know that the politicians aren't going to do what I believe in their hearts they know is the right thing and take care of this phony war on drugs and get it off the table, for the simple reason that once a politician comes out for legalization of drugs, he's automatically a one-term politician. It's just a fact. You see it all the time. Kurt Schmoke was the mayor of Baltimore, and he was ousted because he very casually said in an interview, I think we should look at all aspects of the problem, including legalization. He lost his mayoral position because of that. David wrote a thing for Time magazine that we all signed saying that we would be in favor of jury nullification in any drug cases that did not involve violence. If it wasn't gun charges attached to it or anything like that, we would vote to acquit. And I would do so if I got on a jury.
Is that one of the reasons why you made Chris in The Way Home a different kind of criminal?
Well, yeah. The setup is that he's a white kid from a nice neighborhood in Washington and a loving home and so on. The fact is that when you go out to Oak Hill, it's 99% black kids. Now, why is that? There's plenty of kids on the other side of town that are arrested for marijuana charges and breaking into cars and so on. It's simply because those kids, when they go into court, they've got a good lawyer, they're wearing a suit, they've been coached, they know exactly what to say, and a judge looks at them, and usually he'll say, you know, I'm releasing you into the custody of your parents. I'm not going to send you to jail. So he goes to jail, and the cliche would be kind of like that movie Bad Boys, you know, wow, a white kid going to jail with black kids, it's going to be really horrific. But what happens is that he goes in there, and he makes a lot of friendships, long-standing relationships, and later in the book, he's working with one of his friends laying carpet for his dad, who has a carpet and floor business, and the father has actually reached a hand out and tried to help a lot of these boys with employment. The conflicts in the jail are usually not between the kids. It's not kids swinging on other kids. It's usually kids swinging on guards, to tell you the truth.
Both The Turnaround, the previous novel, and The Way Home deal very closely with father-son relationships. Is that just serendipity that it worked like that, or is there some other issue that you're trying to deal with that is just popping up over and over?
I think it's really interesting, and it's not really written about too much in American literature. And in fact, I don't know if people want to read it. I'm about to find out. You know, the book just came out. I'm going to know pretty soon. But and I've been a father for 18 years. I have a son who's getting ready to graduate high school, another teenage son, and a daughter who's becoming a teenager. And these dynamics, I think, are very dramatic and important to write about. Obviously, not too many of us have been to prison. Not too many of us have kids who have been to prison. But we've all been on both sides of this thing. There's more me and the kid in this book than there is in the father, to tell you the truth, because I remember that feeling of having a tremendous amount of energy and adrenaline and also a lot of confusion in my head. And on the other side, the feeling of a father being helpless when a kid starts to go off the rails.
The carpet laying, what made that choice? I mean, it's pretty obvious for The Turnaround, for instance, setting it in a Greek diner.
Well, right. I had to do no research for that.
Absolutely none. But in The Way Home, the carpet laying, was that just because you knew that it would be part of the plot device?
I like to write about work and show people what it's like to have a job where you actually have to do things with your hands and deal with the public and so on. I had set books in kitchens and bars and lady shoe salesmen, sales floors, electronic sales floors. I wanted to do something different, and I had a friend who has a little company. He let me ride around with him for a couple of weeks, and I went on calls and so on. And
did you lay any carpet?
I've done it before, yeah. It's not work that you want to do as a middle-aged guy because your knees are hurting at the end of the day.
George Pelicanos, The Wire and your books, all of your books, it's obvious as time goes on, are very accurate in terms of street language, street lingo. You, as a middle-aged guy with teenage kids who are not necessarily in that environment, how do you get it right?
It's a lifetime of just being out there. Washington is a it's not what people think. If you haven't lived there, it's not, you know, just the federal government. That's a very small part of our city. Everybody else is working, and in the city they're mainly working class. And I come from that background too. I lived in an ethnic neighborhood growing up, and I still live in a neighborhood that's mostly minority. And my kids are they're of that ilk also. Let me just put it that way. I'm not going to exploit my kids and talk about them in that way, but there's always a ton of kids over my house, and I got my ears open, basically.
And same with the music then, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I love to hear what the young folks are listening to in my neighborhood. And we have indigenous music in Washington called go-go. If you're out on the street on Saturday night and you're at a stoplight, it's usually not hip-hop coming from the open windows of the cars. It's go-go.
One of the things that always struck me was the difference between the two Washingtons, the Washington of the people who live there and the Washington of the people who work there in the government. Is it really that split? Are there people in Washington who work in Washington in white-collar jobs who actually care about the city?
Yeah, but they're the folks that come from a background where there's generations of people had grown up in town. Washington is a majority black city still. It's one of the few cities, I guess, Detroit, Atlanta. That's our culture. And even though it has decreased, when I was a kid, it was 80% black, and now it's 52% black, something like that. But I always think of it as a black city with southern black culture because people came up from the south, and they brought those customs and that culture with them.
One big difference between Turnaround and Way Home is that in the Turnaround, there's black-white conflict, and the Way Home, there isn't.
The Turnaround was based on a racial incident from my youth, and then it moves forward to a time when all these people involved in this incident are trying to figure out, all right, how are we going to put that behind us and move forward? By the time of The Way Home, a lot of it is generally behind us. If you go to the 14th and U Street corridor, which was the epicenter of Black Washington when I was growing up, it is now racially mixed, people of all economic backgrounds, gay and straight. It's actually kind of like Berkeley. For us, it's the dream that everybody's been talking about. It's where we've been trying to get to. It's a very encouraging thing.
Do you think the Obama election has a great deal to do with that? I mean, obviously, you can't have Obama without what came before. But do you think we're seeing something new with the arrival of a black president?
It can't be anything but healthy. The fact of the matter is, people from my generation are, no matter what they say, in their hearts, they're always going to be carrying around a little bit of baggage on the racial front, right? So when I see Obama, you know, I see the first black president. But when my kids see him, they see their president. Imagine what it's going to be like for their kids. It's not even going to be an issue. It can't help but be an extremely positive development, plus the fact that the man is a very strong leader.
This brings us into the area of politics. You said in an interview that the form of crime fiction best allows you to explore social issues as the entryway for political and social comment. How do you think in specific ways that would play into your more recent fiction?
The novels have become, honestly, less crime novels than just straight novels. And they're going to sell me any way they can, you know. I do try to incorporate that and the attendant conflict and the drama that goes with it, because I believe that you've got to have conflict, you've got to have antagonists in fiction to make it compelling. So I'll probably stick with the inclusion of crime, some aspects of crime in my books, but I'll never write a book again where there's a murder in the first chapter and it's solved in the last chapter. I'm just not interested in doing that. In a way, it's sort of a lie anyway. I don't believe that murders can be solved. I think when somebody is gone in a violent way like that, the ripples continue out forever into the community.
So you don't see yourself ever getting back to Derek Strange? Or?
I think I will write about Derek Strange again because he's one of my favorite characters, but I don't think it'll be the same kind of book.
A book like The Way Home or Turnaround, the focus moves toward family, the focus moves toward interrelationships. I'm just curious if there was any key point that pulled you away from what you had been doing before, if it was just transitional anyway.
I think it was a natural transition. As I've gotten older, I've acquired more knowledge. I think I know more than I used to know. My worldview has sort of broadened out to the degree that the books have changed, too. I often, in the early books, I would send the protagonist into a room and start shooting, you know, just to solve everything. And that's sort of a movie-ish kind of influence there, and it usually doesn't happen anymore like that. I'm much more aware of staying on the reality track, trying to show what the characters would do rather than what I want them to do.
Of your cohorts on The Wire, Richard Price, well, he's always been in that area, but but Lehane, Dennis Lehane, is also making those transitions as well. Do you guys still discuss what you're doing since The Wire ended?
Yeah, I'll call up those guys, both of them, actually. I'll call them up, and if I'm jammed up or something like that, and I'll ask for their advice in terms of where I'm going with a book, and they've been very supportive. And Dennis, you know, Dennis is an old friend, and he worked on The Given Day. He worked on that book for many years, and he you know, he's a serious writer.
What I've noticed about all of you is, without disparaging earlier works, there's been a jump in quality, and I wonder if it has to do with the fact that you were all together.
We're competitive. When I sit down and write a book, it's in my mind that I don't want to betray those guys, you know, not just the readers, but also them. When we were in the room together on The Wire, we were very competitive to the point where when we were discussing who would get what script and what scenes, you know, I wanted the most dramatic stuff in my script because I wanted to kick their ass. I mean, there's no question about that. And if Richard would get these real funny scenes, which he was great at, there was nobody better with the humor than Richard was, I would say to Simon, I said, well, why don't you just hand him his Emmy right now, you know? You know, we'd like to have one too, man.
Who worked on the Omar scenes?
Well, we all did. I mean, Omar was in, if he appeared in your script, you wrote the scenes.
Right.
Now, Dennis Lehane killed Omar. That was his script. But I had the death of Stringer Bell. I had the death of Wallace, Frank Sabatka. In all honesty, I have to say that I had the most fortunate relationship there because from day one with David Simon, I had this sort of informal contract where I got the next to the last script of every season, and that's where everything happens.
The Stringer Bell episode, that was the key episode of that season.
And that was directed by Joe Chappelle. It's probably my favorite episode of the series.
Richard Price said one of the interesting things about writing the series, which seems to set it apart, is that the sequences, the scenes were very short, and you had to go from one to another really, really quickly. How did that process, if that process did, change the way you wrote your novels?
I don't know. I mean, as the season wore on, we were trying to cram more and more information into each episode. So towards the end, it should be about 30 beats or scenes to an episode. Towards the end, it was getting to be like 45 scenes to an episode, and you really had to write economically. I do feel like my prose has gotten a lot leaner in the books. If it draws attention to me as a writer, I don't want it in there. I want you to forget that I'm writing the book. I want you completely lost in it, and that often means strip it down.
You said in an interview that you don't outline. You start writing and see where it goes.
That's right. I have a situation when I start. A kid from a good neighborhood goes to juvenile prison in the District of Columbia. That was what I started with. And then I began the book with him talking to his parents in the visiting room in prison. And once I had that, I had three very major characters in the book. I knew who they were, and it became easy to write the rest of the book. In other words, it's about finding who the characters are initially, and then it's going to sound mystical, but the book does begin to write itself after a while because you know who you're in their heads completely.
Well, at that point, I've noticed a lot of authors find one or two characters that they thought would be minor suddenly become larger than life in the book, and they take over the book. And I'm wondering if there were any in The Way Home that did that. And also in The Wire, was there any character that did that?
There were a lot in The Wire. Omar was not supposed to be as big as he was.
He was supposed to be a one-shot, wasn't he?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Snoop was just somebody who was going to walk on and have a line. Slim Charles, played by Anwan Glover, was another one. In the book, the boys that he meets in prison all become major characters in this novel. I didn't even know who they were until I put them in the prison, and I didn't know that I was going to talk about their lives 10 years later either, and what it meant to him and what they meant to each other. So by writing those scenes, I found the plot of the book.
And the development of the father as well.
I knew that I wanted to get deep into that relationship and try to get it from both sides. He's a pretty interesting guy, and in this process, he starts discovering a lot of things about himself. Every father who's had a kid who is in a little bit of trouble or didn't turn out the way they, in the optimum way that they thought that the kid would, questions himself in some way and tries to find the answers to why this happened.
And that's the same journey that the father takes in turnaround as well.
Yes. That's more of a triple generational thing. It's his relationship with his own father and then his son.
One aspect of fiction is the relationship of truth versus accuracy. Some people have said that they'd rather be more accurate just for the sake of accuracy, and others say, well, you know, I'm going to fudge if it brings out truth better. Where do you sit in that divide?
You asked about my process without outlining and so on. One thing I didn't say is that I do a tremendous amount of research before I sit down to write the book. I'll do months of research, whether it's being in the prison or riding with police or sitting in trials or whatever I do. So then I have a lot of ammunition sitting there on my desk when I start to write. Sometimes, because you've done all that work, you feel like you have to put everything in the book, and that's a mistake that a lot of writers make. It's a mistake that I've made in the past, and I learned from it. I'll give you an example. With The Way Home, I changed the name of the prison. It's Oak Hill. I called it Pine Ridge. The reason I did that is I was then free to describe a cell, let's say, and have a gray blanket and not have to go back there and make sure that it's not a light blue blanket on the bed. And I don't want anybody reading it and say, Pelicans doesn't know what he's talking about because we put the marijuana, you know, back in the wall. It wasn't in the ceiling tiles, that sort of thing. You do have to let your imagination go and not be so restricted by your research. But everything in this book is based on fact, I can tell you that.
In The Wire, you delve very deeply into city politics as well as the politics of the newspaper. There were a lot of comments regarding David Simon and his relationship with the newspaper. What about comments from politicians? I don't know how much you did on that, but there was a fictional mayor or city councilman mm-hmm. who became a mayor, and people were saying it was based on the guy who I think became governor of Maryland.
Martin O'Malley.
How did that play out? I mean, when you were talking about it, did you just say, well, go for it and screw the consequences?
Well, pretty much. I mean, we tried to change many things besides the fact that he was a white mayor in a majority black city. We tried to change other things about his ethnicity and so on, but it's undeniable that it was based on a composite of him and some of the other mayors they've had. He was pretty pissed off about it. And in fact, he tried to get us thrown out of Baltimore. And I was there in the room when he called David and said, I'm not going to give you your licenses to shoot. We were 2 weeks away from shooting season two, I think it was. The reason that he didn't want us there is because he had ambitions to become governor of Maryland. And he thought that by depicting Baltimore in this way, which, by the way, was a very realistic depiction of the city, it would lessen his chances of getting the governorship. So somebody tapped him on the shoulder and said, look, those people were spending whatever we were spending, $30, $40 million a year in Baltimore, and there's a lot of Baltimoreans working on the show. Our crew was all local, and we were supporting the catering and everything. So he changed his mind and let us shoot there. But his ambition got in the way of his good sense on that one.
Did you find it strange at all that three of the, maybe more, but three that I know of, the primary actors in the show, at one point, were all British?
If you hear Idris Elba speak,
right,
it's a shock because it's heavy British. He never once slipped when we were shooting. You know, some of the actors we had to go back in and loop their dialogue later on, but never him. He's a consummate actor, man.
Also, Dominic West and the actor who played Carsetti.
That's right. He's very Irish, and Dominic is British. And Dominic slipped once in a while, but It got better as the series went along.
I guess hanging out in Baltimore will do that.
Oh, yeah, they became Baltimoreans. They did.
Where did you find all of the young black performers? I mean, there's a tremendous amount of them in there. And I know we know the story of the girl who portrayed Snoop because it got a lot of publicity.
Right.
But there were so many others, and they were all so good.
Well, the four leads in season four, the four boys in that season, all came from New York. They're professional actors who had done stage and so on. But just about everybody else you see in that show, all the kids on the street, what we call the day players, they have lines and episodes. And those are all kids we found in Baltimore. The guy who played Robert Chu, the guy who played that very heavy guy, he had a little acting school for kids in Baltimore, lower-income kids. And he was just doing it to do something good. And he was feeding us a lot of talent. And we had a really good local casting director, Pat Moran. And we got all these kids from Baltimore, and there's so much talent there. Oftentimes, we'd be on the set in the neighborhood, and some kid would come up to the Video Village or to the craft service table to get some candy or something like that. And Ed and I would see this kid, and we'd say, come here, you know, you think you can act? Because you really can't get that look from a casting agent. You've got to get it from the street. The talent was there, man. It was there.
The Wire never achieved the kind of ratings it probably deserved, but HBO supported you the whole way, right?
Yeah, I'm thankful for that. We never got Soprano-style ratings, never. And they could have easily put us out to pasture. But every year we asked to come back. They let us. They knew that it was sort of hitting this kind of zeitgeist, but it was never going to be big ratings because of the subject matter. And a lot of people just don't want to go there. They see a lot of black faces on screen, which there's never been a show with that large a cast of black actors in a dramatic series. You know, HBO never said this, but I'm going to say it. You know, America maybe wasn't ready for it, and they still gave us a shot and gave us the five seasons we needed to tell our story.
And people I know now who missed it first time are getting it on DVD. I mean,
it's got a life overseas. It's almost a phenomenon in places like Britain.
Did work on The Wire, how did that affect you in terms of trying to sit down for 6 months and write a novel?
It got tight. After season three, I didn't produce because I felt like it was impeding my novel writing. And I ended up writing for the last two seasons. And I really didn't want to give that part of my life up. Writing novels is my first love. And I'll tell you, I mean, I don't think people realize when you're working on a television show, literally you're working 12 to 16 hours a day, 7 months straight. You know, towards the end of the season, you look at the set and the people, the crew, are walking around like zombies. They're pale. They got this vacant look in their eyes, and they're sort of on autopilot. And it takes a lot out of you. In fact, I also commuted from Washington, so I was an hour away both ways. And there were many nights that I never slept in Baltimore because I wanted to see my kids. There were many nights I was driving home 4 or 5 in the morning just to come home and take a shower and get back to Baltimore.
Your involvement was much more intense than over the period than, say, Price's or Lehane's.
Yeah, I was producing the show.
And that required getting the permits and making sure that the actors were there and all that, right?
It's a lot of things. I mean, I was mainly the person on set that was watching the make sure that everything was going to be shot as it was written in terms of the actors and the directors, because the directors were hired guns. They'd come in every 2 weeks, and we wanted every episode to look the same. We wanted the show to look the same. So I was sort of a creative producer rather than the person who is watching the guys make sure they're not taking nails home at the end of the day, you know?
The amateur actors themselves, what's happened to them? Have they gone back to the streets?
Probably some of them have. What's been really tough is you see some of these people that did a tremendous job. They've gone out now and tried to get more work, and I'm tight with some of these people, so they'll call me up and they'll say, you know, I read for this part of a lawyer or a doctor in this show, and they said, you know, you're not right for it. And, you know, they can only see them as thugs or police officers. My thing is, well, why not put a suit on this guy or a surgeon's mask and see if he can act?
Well, Idris Elba certainly has gone on, and I've seen the guy, I don't remember the actor's name, who played Bubbles, and he's done pretty
Andre well. Royo, yeah. I mean, Idris was always going to be, I always thought that was the guy that was going to be a movie star, because not only is he a great actor, he's extremely handsome. And if you meet him, you know, we would be on the set at 3 a.m. and women were hanging out of the windows in the neighborhood screaming at this guy. And they should have been sleeping, but they waited up just to scream at him, you know?
The actor who played Marlowe, he was a professional.
Yeah, he's a very good actor. I think he's going to go on to do some big things.
George Pelicanos, I was going to IMDb and your website. Right as Rain, Curtis Hanson is developing that for a film?
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. It's been in development for a while, but I'm in good hands there, I think.
And there's one other as well.
I'm trying to make Shoe Dog, this old book I wrote that was sort of a pulp noir thing with muscle cars and dual robberies and that kind of thing. I've always wanted to do a Bullet or a French Connection. And actually, I can say this because I'm in San Francisco. It's very corny, but I drive a replica of the Bullet car, limited edition that they made. And they even made the pipes, the exhaust pipes, they even made them, they calibrated them to sound like the pipes in the movie. So I'm a diehard San Francisco guy, Highland Green, V8, five on the floor.
What's the story behind the HBO miniseries, The Pacific?
That is the simple way to say is that it's the sequel to Band of Brothers because it's the same people involved. It's Tom Hanks, it's Steven Spielberg, HBO. It's the Marines in the Pacific, all the campaigns. We have spent several years making it. It's going to air next year, 2010. It's an extraordinary series. That's all I can tell you. I mean, the Pacific War was much more brutal war in many ways than the European theater.
What exactly, aside from being a good writer, do you add, you think, with your particular expertise on D.C., Baltimore area, to a show like The Pacific?
Well, my dad was a Marine who fought in the Pacific. That's why I got involved in it, was to honor him. And I thought I could bring something to it, being the son of a guy who actually fought there in the Philippines.
Is it a multiracial cast?
It is not. Yeah.
It's all white.
Yep.
And that's because it was?
No, you're gonna make me say something that I don't want to say now. It was discussed, put it that way. And that's all I can say.
George Pelicanos, a couple other quick questions. I read that you were a distributor of an early John Woo movie in the United States.
The Killer. I wasn't in the film business. I'd seen the film at a festival, and then I read in the paper that these two guys in Washington, Jim and Ted Pettis, who were these Greek entrepreneurs, they had actually produced the early Coen Brothers films, and they owned 80 movie theaters in town, and they were distributing films. I wrote Ted and Jim a letter, and I said, I want to come work for you guys and put this movie out. When I got there, they were in the process of sort of slowing down the distribution business, so they gave me the ball, and they said, okay, you want to do it? You do it. So I did the poster, the tagline. I moved the prints around the country, all that. And I learned the business that way.
And that probably helped you on some level when you got involved with a show like The Wire.
Well, we ended up producing movies together. So when I got to The Wire and I walked on a set, I knew what I was doing.
George Pelicanos, getting back to your novels, but also in terms of The Wire, too, how much do you think the research into these books changes your own political perspective?
Well, you can't help but be infected when you're out there and you see what's going on. Now, having lived 52 years in Washington, there have been some changes, but there haven't been enough changes, and they haven't happened fast enough for my taste. And you get angry. You know, we've got the federal government there. Why aren't things being done? Why is the school system as poor as it is? Why do we spend $1 trillion on a war that nobody wanted? Instead of that, put money into the schools and job training. You know, if anything, I haven't mellowed. I've gotten angrier as time has gone on, and I want to know why.
Well, I noticed that one of the byproducts of the Bush administration was a growing political consciousness and anger. It showed us, you know, how bad things can be and how bad things can get, and the only way to deal with it is to get angry and try to do something. At least my hope is that that's the direction that we're going in.
Yeah, I think you're right. What I was discussing earlier about jury nullification is an example. If you don't think the laws are right and you don't think that the politicians have the backbones to change those laws, do something about it. You know, it's a form of protest, and we have, as citizens of this country, we have a right to do those kinds of things.
One of the things that has always bothered me about D.C. is that the United States was built on the idea of taxation without representation. The city of D.C. has never been properly represented.
Right. I think that's going to change under our new president. He's in favor of full representation for the city, if not statehood. It's unconstitutional. It's right in there. You don't pay taxes and not have a vote. It's flat out wrong. It's been fought for many years because the city is overwhelmingly Democratic, and the people on the other side don't want another Democratic vote in the House and the Senate. But it's going to happen.
George Pelicanos, music plays a great role in all of your books, and it played a great role in The Wire. It's always there. And I understand you listen to music when you're writing. What were you listening to during the writing of The Way Home?
I listen to a lot of soundtracks, a lot of Western soundtracks, Ennio Morricone, Elmer Bernstein, people like that, and also Lalo Schifrin, Jerry Goldsmith. And it fires up my imagination. It has since I was a kid. I mean, I can tell you every note from The Magnificent Seven. And that movie would not be what it is without the Elmer Bernstein soundtrack. I'm hearing this as I write, and it kind of moves it forward and helps me pace the book.
Do you ever plan to return to characters from Turnaround or Way Home?
No.
No.
No, those stories are told.
Have you begun thinking and working on a new one?
I'm thinking, but I haven't. The lightning bolt of inspiration hasn't struck me yet. It gets kind of scary. I mean, you know, I have my friends who in this business, people like Connolly, Mike Connolly. I'm going to see him next week. Connolly probably has 5 or 6 books in his head already. He just has to sit down and write them. I'm completely not like that, and that's why I have to be sort of out in the world and take a look around and sit in bars and talk to people and so on to get that inspiration.
What about screenplays?
I've adapted Shoe Dog. I'm trying to make that. I've adapted The Big Blowdown, and I'm shopping that around right now. I'm sort of getting proactive about the movie thing because I don't like being at the mercy of other people in the business where they tell you something's happening, and it's really nothing's happening.
What about directing, then?
It's on my plate. I mean, it's something that I want to do, and I believe I will do it.
You've been listening to an interview with George Pelicanos, whose latest novel is The Way Home. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.